trying to escape this futile. Who child is time to jump in too wild? That's why we got more than two styles. To adapt in the situation, too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator, and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all that, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Different African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:07 here in the city of Philadelphia on this fallback hour that we've lost, spring forward, fall back. And it's the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening radio program tonight. Our special guest is author and journalist Dr. Tyrene Wright, and we'll be recapping the Remaking Black Power Summit that was held virtually on October 30th and 31st. You heard it aired on Time for an Awakening Media, which Dr. Wright was a part of, the panel discussions, and also we'll be talking and mixing in conversations about her book, Booker T. Washington in Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist. We'll get the conversation started, and we'll be right back after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies, everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:12 in the city of Philadelphia. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum at 7th and Arch Street here in Philadelphia. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Ellie.
How are you, sir?
You know, I'm doing fine compared to Ellie. You know, it's the Richard weather, body weather report. It's starting to get chilly outside. I don't know if everybody else noticed it. I did. Yesterday, I put on the old, well, whatever.
No, you didn't put no long johns on. I know you didn't.
I'm telling you. I'm telling you, I don't play. I can't play it. It really reinforces I'm a Southern Hemisphere individual. No, I'm a Southern Hemisphere African, because I cannot take this cold, and I ain't been nowhere, have not lived nowhere other than in Philadelphia. And it just gets worse every year, but I'll leave that alone.
Listen, Richard, before we get into the program this evening and I introduce our guests, want to send my heartfelt condolences out to brother the family of Brother Robert Gray that made transition earlier this week. Brother Rob, as everybody knew him, was a heck of an individual. He was a popular talk show host here in Philadelphia for a lot of years until the so-called Jews had him forced off of the terrestrial radio station here. But that didn't stop Brother Rob, because he had the organization, the African American Freedom Reconstruction League, that was doing work in the communities. The meetings was constantly at various libraries around the city. Every month he was showcasing somebody from Scheherazade Ali to authors, to historians. Everybody would come through and be a part of the goings on at the African American Freedom and Reconstruction League meetings. After he was off of the station here in Philadelphia, he helped myself and the host at the time of Time for Awakening, Brother Reggie. We were working with African American farmers, bringing them to Philadelphia, and Brother Rob was instrumental in getting us several locations in the Southwest Philly and North Philly area through connections that he knew, and the folks would come out. Brother Rob was respected throughout the city.
Yes, he was.
I know the ancestors are going to be pleased to have him join their ranks. He was a good man. I know that Brother Tommy and some of the other people over there will keep the African American Freedom and Reconstruction League going. In fact, you know, Richard, the moderator of Friday's summit meeting, the discussion, the moderator, Brother Shamari, I first met him through Brother Rob. He, 'cause he had written a book at the time, Why Our Children Hate Us.
Right.
And he came on the program. Brother Rob told me to have him on the program. And he came on, Brother Shamari came on about 2-3 times on Time for Awakening when we were on terrestrial radio. So I met Brother Shamari through Brother Rob, a good man, and he's going to be missed. So I didn't want to do the program this evening until I mentioned it. In fact, we'll probably have some callers call in during the time period of this program and kind of do some reflections on Brother Rob. Brother Rob always had some one-liners. Boy, you know, Brother Reggie sent me some of his one-liners. I might read some of them. He had some. Brother Rob, he was a good man. He had some. He was quick. He was quick with the wit, Brother Rob, and the knowledge. So he was a good man, and he's going to be missed. To make transition into that, we aired the remaking of Black Power Virtual Summit on a Friday evening, and on Saturday evening I put it up on podcast. It's on the Time for Awakening website and Facebook page for folks that didn't hear it. Very interesting dialogue between I think it was 12 activists on Friday and 12 on Saturday.
Yes.
From all over the country, talking about the work that they were doing and just developing ideas and strategies to move our people forward. Our guest this evening was part of the panel discussion on Friday, and we're going to do some reflections on some of the things, at least for the listening audience, so they can get a little taste of what happened during the virtual summit discussions, panel discussions, and talk about her book, Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist. That'll be very interesting, too, because it was some things that I wasn't really aware of about our elder. But it'll be good to have Dr. Tyrene Wright in discussion with us this evening. Dr. Wright, how are you?
Hello. I'm well. I'm here.
Okay. Oh, it's good to have you on Time for an Awakening. And I think this is your first time here.
Yes, and thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Wright, before we kind of get started with things this evening, because I want to kind of recap and get your reflections on the Remaking Black Power Summit. Okay. Tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself as a journalist and an author and a teacher up there at New York University, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, no, City University of New York.
Good. Okay.
Yes, CUNY. The other large university. So, yeah. Well, you know my name, and I teach for the City University of New York, and I'm a native New Yorker, I guess, if you can say. I've been doing it a long time. I used to actually go to school very briefly down here in Philadelphia. I did some graduate work at Temple at one point. I think you're asking me all of that because of one specific thing, which is this book that I wrote. So I'm actually a historian, or I theorize as both a historian and political scientist. And let me just say this. I did write a book on Booker T. Washington and Africa. The subtitle is The Making of a Pan-Africanist. So the title is Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist. And I shouldn't leave out, because I always do leave this out, because it had nothing to do with really my writing of the book, although it lent some insight, but I am a Tuskegee alumni, extremely proud Tuskegee alumni. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I went to Tuskegee on the undergraduate level, and I was a student of history. I was a history major when I was at Tuskegee. So I had no idea I would end up writing such a book, but certainly it helped.
Okay.
Many moons later, probably like 15 years later, okay, I wrote that book. So that's a little bit about me. The book is actually a culmination of history, sort of a biographical sketch of Washington's role in Africa, but then also some political science, and in the sense that there are two policy cases. So this is not just philosophical thought. This is all concrete historical and political facts that are from Booker T. Washington's personal papers. And this came about as a result of looking at his personal papers and knowing that he had a very clandestine role in Africa, but not quite knowing a lot about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and so just side note, how I did get a cue, because we always have something that ignites this kind of research, but I got a cue from Manning Marable. Manning Marable, many years before I began my work, wrote an article called Booker T. Washington and African Nationalism. And I found that in that work, it was just an article, but he created sort of a laundry list of Washington's role in Africa and all his African nationalist affiliates. And so from there, I said, well, listen, I'm not going to listen to Manny Marable solely. I'm going to go see what's in his personal papers. And I was able to go through his personal papers, which most people probably know is a massive collection of all his personal correspondence. It is in 15 volumes, each volume between 300 to 500 pages each of correspondence between him and various people throughout the world and domestically as well. However, my focus was solely on his commentary, his private conversations about Africa, and his private conversations with African nationalists who were on the continent at that time. And there turned out to be a wealth of information, and out of that developed these two cases. One, the Liberian crisis, where Washington is the key negotiator in negotiating the fate of Liberia between 1907 and 1912 as a result of the French, British, and Germans trying to annex the territory. And then, of course, the second case in the book is really a critical case, a short but very important and critical case, in the sense that it is the African exclusion measure, which was legislation passed by the Senate to exclude anyone of the Black or African race in 1915. And this amendment was attached to the larger immigration bill. It was due to go before the House in Washington with his Tuskegee machine and his maneuvering, is able to have it shut down in the Congress, and made it clear that he would have done anything to do that. You have to read the book to find out how he does it. But he is the person who challenged that, even though this was a measure that would not have impacted him, right? Personally, he was already in America, but it was a measure that targeted the African and Black population from coming specifically from the Caribbean, Central and South America, but it would extend to everyone, inclusive of the African continent. And it was provoked by the completion of the Panama Canal, which many of us know the laborers on the Panama Canal were the African and Black inhabitants of the Caribbean, Central and South America, right? So that's essentially what the book is about. And it's a lot. I address a lot in there, the Du Bois, Washington debacle, but also the arrival and the relationship he had with Marcus Garvey. As we know, Garvey was inspired by Washington, invited to the U.S. by Washington, came to the United States to see Tuskegee, and also wouldn't have gotten into the United States had Washington failed to pass that measure that I just mentioned. The African had failed to defeat, not pass, I'm sorry, failed to defeat the African exclusion measure, which was defeated in January 1915, and Garvey would come into the United States in March of 1916, 4 months after Washington died, but a year and 2 months after the measure had been defeated. So that's kind of just a little bit of what the book is about. And it's all primary, so you get to see the direct conversations. Very good teaching book, right, because it references all primary sources. So you can go straight to the Booker T. Washington papers and see the actual documents and correspondence that this book comes out of.
You know, they left me at a disadvantage, Elliot. And Professor Wright, because as I was one part that I'll open up later, I was looking for I seen the reference and it said Washington papers and I said, well, dang, I can't get this and that. But I'll bring that up.
You can get it.
Yeah, I mean, I just at that moment I was bringing that up because we'll get to that later. Go ahead. Excuse me. I just wanted to bring that up.
No, wait a minute, okay. Because I heard you say that you can get those. How would you get access to that type of information, Dr. Wright?
Yeah. So, okay. At the time that I was doing this research, which was quite a while ago now, because the book has been out for about 5 years, but at the time that I was doing this research, it was on the University of Chicago at Illinois, online library where you could actually do a search within the collection of his papers, all 15 volumes, and pull up anything you wanted. Now, since then, they, for some reason, maybe they lost their funding and it's no longer available that way. But you can go to any library that has a collection, a special collection, or just a collection has the Booker T. Washington papers. Let me say that. So if you're in the New York area, or I'm not sure how it works in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, where you would, but I'm pretty sure the main libraries, right? And what is it called? The free library. Some of them have, particularly the main one, have a collection of Booker T. Washington papers. And, also, if you search the Booker T. Washington papers on Google Docs actually does have the volumes and you can buy them one by one. That's the other thing too. But you know, it's an extensive collection because it's 15 volumes. And let me just say this. Why it was important for me to do this work is because all 15 volumes of those papers were edited by Lewis Harlan. And Lewis Harlan is a white male scholar born, you know, in the 40s. And he was allowed to be Washington's sole biographer. He wrote two biographies on Washington. He edited all of Booker T. Washington's personal papers through a grant from the Library of Congress. He wrote numerous, numerous articles on Washington, but he was very open about his disdain for Booker T. Washington. And so I also am aware, now this is a part of being alumni came in, I knew the head archivist and the assistant archivist at the time that Lewis Harlan was actually in Tuskegee as a young man working on the Booker T. Washington paper. And, you know, the consensus amongst both was that he was never truly committed to the project. Therefore, when going through the papers, you see numerous errors and assumptions and presumptions made by Lewis Harlan in the editorial notes of Washington's personal papers. So he can't alter the actual correspondence, right? You're just transcribing that. But he gives his own interpretation and or notes, editorial notes at the end of each document, right? Since he is the editor of the papers. And that's very problematic because how could he know, understand a figure like Washington? Many of us would have a problem even if we're Black, right? This is a man that was born in enslavement, survived it, and would rise to the level of not simply being a college principal and the father of Tuskegee, but really being a international figure and really having his hands in some major things, including the survival of Liberia. So, you know, I don't think Lewis Harlan was the right person. Now, that being said, we allowed that. We being Black people, African people who would consider Washington an ancestor, okay? We allowed there to be a monopoly of the interpretation of Booker T. Washington. And there is a 100-year discourse in the academy around this that goes uninterrupted amongst white liberals, okay, who have dominated this conversation, which has a lot to do with the politics even behind my book. But the point is that we did not, there were no scholars there were no Black scholars, African scholars who interrupted this, with the exception of maybe two who wrote one or two articles and said, hey, wait a minute, you know. But for the most part here domestically, no one interrupted the monopoly Lewis Harlan had, and no one challenged the fact that white liberal scholars were able to effectively malign Washington to the point where no Black or African scholars felt comfortable even touching him. One article I read over the course of my research said that to deal with Washington could be suicide to one's career. And of course, certainly I wasn't going to go along with that, but the point is that the fact that the person even stated and wrote that, he had been so isolated and polarized, and we have so accepted their interpretation of who he was that no one would touch Washington. You mention him and it's like, oh, no, because certainly Du Bois was the most progressive one. And I decode their relationship too, not through my own opinion, but through their personal papers and correspondence, what Du Bois said to him, what he said to Du Bois, and the context at the time, which is something very different than what we've been taught. So, you know, that's like one of the caveats of the book. And my premise is just kind of like whatever Washington was or wasn't, he belongs to us, and we will either praise him or condemn him based on what he said he was going to do for us and how effective he was at that. That was our job to do, good, bad, or indifferent. So we needed to have the courage to do that.
And one of the things that, you know, now that you said that, because it goes to the point that I seen in your book that I wanted to explore more, and just my laziness, I'm going to put it at that, because you had raised that in the and it's the two articles. One was Christianizing Africa, and it was another one that wasn't published that where he was making reference to an anti-imperialist position. And I, this is something I never really heard anybody make reference in it to Booker T, that he had a anti-imperialist position.
Sure, certainly, yes. And I mean, in action and literally, I mean, when asked by a venture capitalist from the United States if he would support colonizing the Negro in the Sudan, makes it clear, like, good luck to you, but I don't support colonizing the Negro here, there, or anywhere. So yes, and he was very critical of the presence of, or the use of Christianity in the colonization of Africa, particularly Africa.
Dr. Wright,
King Leopold.
I'm kind of losing. I'm kind of losing your audio. You're kind of breaking up. I don't know whether.
Okay. All right. Let me see if that's where you. Let me take my notes with me, though. let me move around. They can hear me a little.
You were mentioning about the Christianizing aspect, Christianizing Africa, right, making reference to that. His view about that.
Can you hear me better?
Well, it sounds a little scratchy, but go ahead. I'll let you know. Go ahead.
Okay. Better now?
That's good.
Is that any better?
Yes. Yes.
So, Washington involved in propaganda against the Congo Free State. He also a position organization.
You know what, Dr. Wright? What we'll do, we'll take a brief break, and maybe we can get like a little better connection.
Okay. So you want me to? Okay.
Yeah, if you can dial right back in.
Okay, we'll do that.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll take a little brief break, Richard, and when we come back, hopefully.
Yeah, this part I didn't really know. And I apologize for interjecting, but, you know, it's the thought.
Well, you know what? Well, maybe we won't take a break because she'll probably try to get back in. Here she is. Dr. Wright?
Okay, I'm back in. Yes, I'm back in.
Okay.
Is that any better?
Yeah, let's try that. Go ahead.
Okay. So Booker T. Washington was involved in propagandizing against the Congo Free State under King Leopold, but he also took a position, an officer position in Friends of the Congo, which is the organization that still exists today. So he was the vice president of the Friends of the Congo, and he actually engaged under Theodore Roosevelt's administration, lobbying the White House on issues related to the Congo. So even though he was an advisor to Theodore Roosevelt, he also was involved in, obviously, challenging the U.S. position, which some may know, the United States is the first country to give a nod to King Leopold being the sole owner of the Congo Free State. So can you imagine the United States affirms this sole ownership of the Congo by this Belgian king who never stepped foot in the Congo?
Amazing, and the atrocities that were done in the Congo in his name,
to produce rubber, forced labor, you know, which is certainly comparable to enslavement and the atrocities that came along with it, right? Mm-hmm. So this is what Washington wrote a number of articles, and that is part of in chapter 4 of the book, that is part of the discourse outlining the series of articles, but also addressing just not just King Leopold, but what was happening in South Africa as well, right? Because of the European presence in South Africa and their avid use of Christianity as a tool of colonization. He was very critical of that. To the point where eventually he did get the attention in terms of the Congo. He did get the attention of King Leopold, whose aides invite him to Belgium. And he ultimately says, no, thanks. I'm not coming to Belgium, which was probably a good idea. He may not have made it back, but King Leopold and his aides did recognize that someone who had international recognition like Washington could galvanize people around the issue, okay? And so he continues to write and propagandize against the atrocities as long as possible, right? So he writes many articles, or many articles are authored. Some speculate, because I do know that Robert Parks, the sociologist from the University of Chicago, was working for Washington at the time, and he did clue him into the issue in terms of the Congo. And so hence begins a whole journey and a litany of articles written in respect to that.
Dr. Wright, when did he first, Booker T. start first writing the articles on the Congo?
At the turn of the century, so shortly after 1900, I actually, in the book, they are, you know, I give the citations, like the page or the paragraph from the collection, because it would be hard to find if someone just didn't know. But the point is that shortly after the turn of the century.
Now,
so literally shortly after 1900.
Now, being that you looked in his private papers and letters, did he mention anything about maybe him kind of picking up the work that George Washington Williams had written about the Congo? Did he mention anything about...
No, he doesn't, not that I recall.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay.
No. Mm-mm. So a lot of people are surprised. Recently, someone made a comment to me because I did assert that I couldn't find anything that said Washington was exceptionally religious, or even I wouldn't really know. I never came across anything that denoted his religious denomination, right? And that being because two things. One, he aggressively talked about Christianity, right, as a tool of colonization. And that is in light of the fact that this Washington is someone who's criticizing that. But if one read the story of the Negro, the rise of the race from slavery, which was probably written around 1900 but wasn't published until 1909, Washington discusses the fact that he wanted to go to Africa. However, he realized that, you know, he said he didn't know any black people from America who could go to Africa, so he except for missionaries. So he was willing to be a missionary. But then he comes to the conclusion that once he's at Tuskegee, which he is there very early in his life, right, 26, he's in a leadership position at Tuskegee, and he realizes that I'll never make it there, but I have something here that I can perfect and share with Africa, and I can get it on the continent of Africa through my students. And so thus begins a whole odyssey of him making sure that he has international students, and particularly a steady stream of students or flow of students from the African continent, the first coming in 1893 that we know of, but also students from around the world, right? In the Western Hemisphere, for Black and African students, Tuskegee would become a hub of sorts. But in terms of how Washington exports the Tuskegee model, which is his gift to Africa, he does that through his international students from Africa, through his graduates from Tuskegee, and then through the African nationalists who he is in close contact with on the continent of Africa, who are sharing the details and the nuances of their condition on the continent at the time under colonialism.
Another thing that struck me as I, you know, went through your book is that the relationship between him and Sylvester Williams in relationship to the first Pan-African Congress, you know, and that being so early on, right? And I'm hearing you say even the Tuskegee model being presented in 93, but their exchanges in 98, you know, which is the beginning of even the, you know, popularizing the term Pan-African.
Yeah.
You know, can you just expand on that, you know, for us?
Sure. From what I recall, I believe the first time Henry Sylvester Williams actually contacts Booker T. Washington is 1897, and he writes him from London, and he asks him if he would participate in the plenary sessions for the first Pan-African conference that he is planning via the African Association, and to happen in 1900 in London. And Washington accepts. They begin, so that was the first correspondence that's documented in the Booker T. Washington papers. And then they began, you know, just correspondence back and forth over the years leading up to the actual conference in 1900. During that time, Washington actually would attend a couple of plenary sessions. At least one of those sessions he attends with Du Bois, because Washington and Du Bois had a 9-year relationship that was intact long before the publication of Souls of Black Folks, which people speculate became a rift between them. It's not really true. That wasn't a rift between them. However, there were other things that were going on, and I could talk about that if you'd like me to briefly, but the point is that Du Bois and Washington are on good terms and attend one of the plenary, at least one of the plenary sessions for the first Pan-African conference to be held in 1900 together. Washington would not attend the conference in 1900. Why? It's not really clear, but it's not because of Du Bois. It's because of other commitments. However, Henry Sylvester Williams contacted Washington because he was asking him to promote the first Pan-African conference in the United States. And why would he ask him to do that? It was a well-known fact that Booker T. Washington had significant influence and control and power in terms of the black press in the United States. And this is the way that he would, you know, put his message out and also control to some extent what was put out or what was said. And so to get something widely promoted like the first Pan-African conference, Booker T. Washington would be the key person. He, in response to Henry Sylvester Williams, says that this is very important. He calls it a movement. Not even very early on, he sees this as a movement. You can Google this. This is like something you can see on Wikipedia, but of course, you know, you can see the actual correspondence in the Washington papers. But Washington says he thinks this is a very important conference that won't be just a conference, but a movement that is budding in the world because Pan-Africanism is new. Henry Sylvester Williams asked Washington initially to write a paper and present a paper on lynching. Washington accepts, but then before 1900, he writes him again and says, could you write a paper on sustainability? And both of those are indication, in my opinion, because of what Washington was actually doing. Most people wouldn't associate Washington with lynching because publicly he did not take the position around lynching that some might have thought. However, what Washington is responsible with regard to lynching is he is the compiler of the largest collection of lynchings in the United States. It's called the Tuskegee University Lynching Files. And so from 1895 to the point of Washington's death in 1915, Washington has obviously, as an institutional leader, has subscriptions to every paper in the United States. And literally, he himself cut out and documented all the lynchings that were being published in the papers across the United States. Out of this comes this massive collection. But what he's really doing is extracting logistical information from these articles. Where, why, who, all of this data. And this would have been to his interest because if anybody understands the position of Tuskegee in Alabama and in the South in general, it would have been something that he needed to understand and map for the security of himself and really to the security of this whole community, which some would argue, I might argue, was an industrial community of people, right, who were his students. But then later on, you see Henry Sylvester Williams ask him to present a paper on sustainability. which is very interesting that he would have asked him that, because yes, Tuskegee is a sustainable model. And that is something that Washington is seeking to perfect. It has 44 industries. They are producing everything that is consumed and is necessary for human survival. And it becomes a model of sustainability for African people, which Washington is seeking to export primarily to the African world.
Thank you for that.
You know, what you've had described to us, Dr. Wright, is in itself a problem. And when I say a problem, I'm saying this. And it kind of leads us into the necessity for the conference that was held over the weekend and future conferences and movements and actions that need to be taken moving forward. When you talked about the documentation of Booker T. Washington's life, his papers and things of that nature being handled by people that hate us, avowed racists, people that hated Washington, that shows us two problems to me. One, I wasn't aware of his activities as far as being a Pan-Africanist, and my parents, both of them, and their ancestors now, but they raised me and my family, my brothers and sisters, steeped in our history. And I knew about Washington's activities here and what he was doing, you know, as much as we knew historically. Never knew anything about his activities dealing with the continent. Right. Now, that in and itself is a problem, especially when you're a colonized people and not a free people, that you're not in control of your education. But you mentioned another thing, too, that's a problem that we rarely discuss as a problem, which you mentioned about. Black scholars didn't say anything in reference to this being done.
Blacks
who has a semblance of control over what our people can hear, what our people can understand, or what they know about their ancestors, have no problem in having racists control the information that our children receive about their ancestors. That in itself is a two-edged sword and a double problem. But go ahead. Go ahead. You speak to that issue.
The first issue, meaning that not knowing Washington was a Pan-Africanist,
yes.
Or the second issue?
Yeah, well, both of them, because that
okay.
Other people being in control of our education, in control of our lives, period, is a problem.
Right, very much so. Well, first, Washington is one of the first people involved in the first Pan-African Conference in terms of the people that Henry Sylvester Williams and the African Association contacts, right? However, you know, Pan-Africanism as a term, it's budding in the world, and they all gather under this basic premise to unify for the purpose of eradicating oppression for African people everywhere, wherever we may be. That is the bare bones definition that is asserted by the African Association as the impetus for the conference. That being said, Washington, the book is really a story of Washington's transformation from whomever he was, American Negro possibly, to a Pan-Africanist, and really someone who affirmed, right, someone who asserted that his homeland was Africa. I mean, he writes a whole book about it, and it goes unnoticed, meaning the story of the Negro, the rise of the race from slavery, is a book all about the Negro at home. And he goes, but what's home? What is he talking about? He's talking about Africa as home. And two-thirds of the book is all about our reality and our life on the continent of Africa. It went largely unnoticed and unrecognized because in 1909, the hot conversation was about social and political rights of Black people in the United States. Du Bois had emerged. He was saying that we have a right to enter the social and political realm of American society. We earned this. This is a result of our victory in the Civil War, and we shouldn't, focus on pretty much anything else. And this idea, of course, is talented. Yeah. However, Washington was talking about Africa in the story of the Negro. And that did not meet the satisfaction of people who felt that he, as a visible leader in the United States, should be talking about. He should be talking about social and political rights. Now, Washington is a peculiar individual because he's not opposed to political rights. However, what he was writing about at that given moment just wasn't that. He was writing about something else, and he was always doing things, right? But much of what Washington does and why we don't know him as a Pan-Africanist is because he would never announce his role in the Liberian crisis. Right. He had no reason to, because largely it involved a lot of secret correspondence, secret meetings, meaning one of the meetings that happened during this case, the Liberian crisis, is that he brings the Liberian commission or delegation from Liberia to the White House under Theodore Roosevelt right before a change of administration to Taft. And they come to the White House to meet with Roosevelt, Taft, and the Secretary of State, Elihu Root. And why does he do that? Because he's seeking to protect any negotiations that are put in place through this change of administration, because certainly he doesn't trust these white men, clearly. He feels like a change of administration will derail the negotiations and the promises made to Liberia. So he uses his leverage to get them an in-person meeting. Anybody who knows modern, U.S. government or, the structural politics here, any country appealing to the United States goes through the State Department. They don't have a secret meeting at the White House. That's just not how it works. But he was able to facilitate that. That wasn't broadcast in the news. That wasn't, and he did want to have pomp and circumstance with the Liberian Commission. But Roosevelt says, hey, Liberia is in a bad way. This is not a good thing. And he's so excited because he is seeing himself in them, right? These are African people who survived enslavement and repatriated on the continent, and they are having a return. So he instead invites them to Tuskegee first, and they spend several days, which if you have the book or see the cover of the book on the internet anywhere or on the book's website, you see that there is an image and shadows on the cover of the book. That's the Liberian Commission in the garden at Tuskegee. So there is physical, there's documented, visual evidence that they were in fact here and they were in fact in Tuskegee with Washington, right? If you go to the chapter with the case, you see the outright picture. Mm-hmm. But on the book, those people sitting at the bottom of the image in the shadows, that's who that is, the Liberian Commission to the U.S. But that being said, certainly that was a Pan-Africanist effort. Now, there are some critics of the book in the case. Now, they haven't read the case, but there are people who will say Washington was the line in preserving Liberia. That's the typical Americo-Liberian position. Absolutely not. Because if you get through the case, you see the recommendations Washington gives directly to the Liberian Commission and their officials in leadership in Liberia. And one of the main things he criticizes, if it's not first, it is the main thing. And I think, from what I recall, it might be the first thing on his list in his criticism to them, which is that you must resolve the very legitimate grievance that the indigenous Liberian has with the presence and with the Americo-Liberian population. The fact that these people would go there and institutionalize a system of discrimination against the indigenous African person is reprehensible. And he actually foreshadows that if this issue is not resolved, this will be the death of the nation. This is something that is going to fester. And he was right, okay? We do know, fast forward, much of conflict in Liberia comes out of the presence of the Americo-Liberian population being the holders of power and certainly the holders of political power, right? So it is an announcement of his pan-African consciousness, even to the point where, you know, I start that chapter by quoting Washington, and loosely this is what he says: no one, not even the native Liberian, is more interested in the fate of Liberia than I am. Now, what a thing to say. I mean, this is how he feels. Nobody is more, you know, and I would do anything. He makes that clear. The white men he is negotiating with here are so uncomfortable with his attitude about Liberia that they, one, I believe it's Elihu Root, says to him, oh, no, you, because he wanted to go and take an official position in the government of Liberia. And I believe it's Elihu Root who says to him, no, you know, you can help Liberia better here as an American, which you are, versus as a Liberian, which you are not. You understand this white man trying to tell him, like, hey, because he sees that Washington is, you know, maybe in his opinion, over-identifying with the Liberian position, right? But that lets you know that he's not even able to hide that. And he's not taking the position of the typical Americo-Liberian in the sense that because I come from America, I am better than the indigenous African person in Liberia and I should marginalize them. He's not taking that position at all. He is exceptionally critical of that position and says, you know, and says what I mentioned before, that it'll be the death of Liberia. It will destroy the nation. But that being said, it was a case.
Taking that geopolitical perspective, a power positioning perspective, from an African-American position, agency.
Right, absolutely. And he was on the right side, because we have to be, much of what came up in the conference that we did was certainly, of course, repatriation to Africa as some options in the future. And if we, if any large number of African people in America do something like that, the Liberian context, and in even this case, are things to look at, because we have to have a different posture on the African continent.
I think you mentioned that you were adamant about that in that discussion, that if it was going to happen, that would have to be addressed.
Oh yeah, certainly, because, you know, someone stated, and I think it was Brother Sekou Odinga, who stated, like, you know, 50 million African people from the United States aren't going to go to Africa. And I said, well, certainly not. And I hope not. Because, you know, you just transplant all the folks that we have here and there. And you talked about tons of problems.
Lord.
You know, like, there's some folks, I don't want them to, you know, be in the same community with me either. So, I mean, we're not going to solve problems by just transplanting ourselves. But certainly, we've got to look at our contradictions and certainly understand to the impact that being in American society has had on us, to the degree that we could see ourselves as colonizers. Because I just recently read something. I teach an international, which is something I didn't mention this weekend, but I teach an international course to many, many African nationals on the continent of Africa, young people and young professionals on Pan-Africanism and Pan-African organizing. And we discussed this very issue, this idea that, you know, this is just another layer of ethnic conflict, because certainly we have constructed ethnicity out here, right, as a result of being here for the last 400 years.
Yes.
We are an ethnic group. We have constructed a common history. We have constructed culture, and it is survival culture, but it is culture nonetheless. And the reality is that transplanted to the African continent, we will engage other ethnic groups, and we have to know how to navigate those interactions without this air or this image of superiority. That is, you know, that can't be part of it. We can go in peace. Why can't we see that? You understand? You're forced to live here in peace for the most part. Do you get what I'm saying? Meaning we're not staging any big thing here where the people and the society and the government are openly opposed to our survival and thriving and all of that and well-being. So why do you feel like you can't go to the African continent and live in peace and not be disruptive? So we do have to be critical of that, right? And this African-American nationalism. So in the context of the course I mentioned that I teach, Garvey, we look at Garvey, and Garvey refers to the Liberian case as African-American colonization. And I think that that's problematic. Not that he said that, but the fact that in many instances, this could be seen as a African-American colonization project, right? Liberia, you know, and that's deeply problematic because who are we to colonize anyone?
This is what we'll do. We'll take a brief break. And when we come back, because what you're raising now, Dr. Wright, is a good way to transition into subjects that was dealt with over the weekend. Friday and Saturday. And I think that it's going to be an interesting conversation. We'll get the callers involved, and they can always do that by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation this evening with author and journalist Dr. Tyrene Wright. The book Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist. And we'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $221 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds and wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:16 here in the city of Philadelphia, and you're in the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening, author and journalist, Dr. Tyrene Wright. The book, Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of Pan-Africanists, and you can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Before I go to the phones with a couple callers here, Dr. Wright.
Yes.
During the break, I played a collage of some of our ancestors' voices. And the first two, Dr. King talked about that he got our people to buy into his dream. But and he convinced our people to have faith in people who too often proved to be unfaithful. Now, he was talking about Europeans. The second collage, when Malcolm is addressed, and he talked about these civil rights things and things is pointing to change the white man's mind, but our own mind needs to be changed. To me, that's the key in anything, because when you mentioned just before the break about repatriating, and the problem is if millions of our people repatriated to the continent, that we would be suffering some of the same things that we're dealing with here. Is because our minds needs to be changed. We need a reclamation of our minds, and because our minds have been poisoned by Europeans. That's just the raw facts about it. Our minds need to be changed, and we need to work on these things while we're here. Because, I mean, some of our people have repatriated. I think that you had lived on the continent for a number of years before you came back, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But
Senegal for a little while.
But we really need a reclamation of our minds, and these things need to be worked on while we're here.
Absolutely.
Speak to that before I go to a couple of these callers and bring some of the callers into the conversation.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where that came up as viable solutions, and I think it should always come up, because let's recall the history really quickly. Any time Henry McNeil Turner, right, or
yes.
Bishop Henry McNeil Turner,
yes,
who Washington is in contact with, Marcus Garvey or others talk about expatriating to Africa, they have been sort of maligned as well in history, right? Oh, because that's a little crazy, right, going back to Africa. However, the most successful back to Africa operation was staged by racist whites, and nobody calls that crazy, right? And that hence the initiation really of Liberia in 1847. That's the American Colonization Society. They are openly racist, and they are open about the fact that they will never share power with black people in this country. There will never be true equality, and so let's remedy this. And they, American Colonization Society, is directly responsible for repatriating thousands of African people who survived enslavement in this country. And no one calls that crazy. So whenever white people say, get out of here, we're going to pay for you to get out of here, that's not crazy. But if an African person who has survived all that we have survived says, I get it, I'm getting out of here, and I don't want to invest anymore, that is, you know, stereotyped or typified as crazy. I think that's very problematic, to be quite frank with you. And I think it speaks to our collective self-esteem. But the other thing is that we have gotten into this space where we can't imagine ourselves without America. And I can see so many other solutions to our problem that don't include America. How about we use America as an extraction site in the same way they have used our communities and Africa itself as extraction sites for their sustaining? And, you know, for our young people, the reality is this. In about 20 years ago, there was at least a 500,000 African, so-called American expats in Africa, in West Africa in particular. However, we don't seem to talk about that. And then you can imagine there's far more presently, okay, in the in West Africa, but in different parts of Africa. We have to, one, come to terms with that everybody doesn't see themselves as continuing this thing with the American paradigm. But two, we can't, and I wish I had the chance to say this at the conference, but we cannot condemn our descendants to fighting this, okay? There were many points in that conference that were important. People repeatedly said, we created this, we built this. Yes, we created this, we built this. That means when we do it for ourselves, we can do it even better.
There you go.
We can build something greater. We can build something better, because that will be under our own volition. We will choose to do that. No one, no African born in the Western Hemisphere chose to be born in the Western Hemisphere. It was our presence in the Western Hemisphere is indicative of the fact that our ancestors' choice was taken from them, right? There was their choice was taken. Nobody was to be kidnapped and never to return. I mean, the tragedy in that, which we don't really even deal with that, right? So we can't condemn our descendants to this because we are now afraid of the rest of the world, and we have bought into this propaganda machine that America is the best place on earth. No, America hasn't been anything without us, right? So we created this better America, right? So we should be able to imagine creating something better for ourselves. Now, it doesn't mean that we won't have problems, right? Everybody has problems. But the young man who was on the conference, his last name was Russell. I forget his first name, but he's Tory, from
Brother
Ferguson.
Tory Russell. Mm-hmm.
Yes. He said, you know, we need to stop having oppressed people's problems and have free people's problems. Yes, putting ourselves on the African continent, we will have free people problems, not oppressed people's problems. And that's the significant difference, right? The life is full of problems and problem solving. But you have to decide whether or not what kind of problems you want to deal with. And the reality is here in the United States, we are still, regardless of the trinkets and the material comfort that many people have achieved here, we're still at ground zero. You can lose it all in one night on the streets. Okay, because if you don't have life, you don't have anything. So that's the other thing that, you know, we've got to open up that conversation. And I do think that, you know, I'm a certain age. I'm an Xer. I'm a Generation Xer. But I do think that there should be a little more encouragement from my elder scholars to go in that direction. And I don't see that being encouraged, okay? It's usually like, oh, we'll stay here. Don't step out. And I, you know, I was fine. I made one critical mistake, which was when I expatriated, I taught at the university and struck at the job. I have familial ties in Senegal. That being said, I returned to get my PhD in the United States. And that began, you know, a whole entanglement of being here, being back much longer than I planned. But the reality is that it's doable, okay? It's possible. And there are a lot of people, you know, there are networks already on the continent, and you do have to know how to navigate that, you know. But it's possible. This attitude that we shouldn't do that is problematic. I'll take it even a step further. I was privy to a conversation where, and I don't want to say, I'm not going to say the individuals, but I was privy to a conversation with an elder scholar around having a well-established business there in West Africa. They expressed that there were some problems with the billing and cost and paying. And they said that in order to avoid having to pay X amount of dollars or monies in excess to the regular business there, some of them or one of them would have to marry an indigenous African person. And it's like, oh, well, you would have to marry one of them in order to get out of these kind of situations. And I said, okay, well, and what's wrong with that? The way it was said was like, you would have to do that. Certainly you wouldn't want to do that. But guess what? The Chinese are all over East Africa and even West Africa, but certainly taking over East Africa. And guess what they're doing? They're marrying African women because they will produce little brown babies who are born on the African continent but loyal to China.
Yes.
In order to stake claims to the African continent. And I said that. I said that in the conference. I said, do you understand that the Chinese hate us? They hate us, but they understand if they are going to move forward into the future and be sustainable at all, they've got to get a piece of Africa. Now, we have birthright as far as I'm concerned. I'll say I'm indigenous, but I'm indigenous to Africa. And so if everybody in the world knows that they've got got to have their hand in Africa in order to be able to go into the future. Why are we so confused about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm somebody who had, so I had two kind of lives. I traveled Africa for many years just as someone who is trying to educate myself on a different level, right? I've done all the book stuff I could do. And then I wanted to see, right, which is another layer of education. But fast forward 10 years in, I married a continental African person. So I actually had I entered the population and I had a whole different experience, right? And it wasn't horrible. It wasn't horrific. So yeah, we can marry each other. That's okay. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. But it's okay too. Like, and why not? Why can't we marry a continental Africa and have some land rights? Right? I mean, like, what's wrong with that? Why is it? Because we marry everybody else.
I know it. I know it.
Okay, and we don't tell anybody. Well, you would have to marry so and so for this to run smoothly, as a deterrent or as the last thing you would want to do, you know. And so we need to open up our minds as far as that's concerned. We need to give the future generations some other options, and they don't have to be condemned to this thing called America.
Exactly.
Right. Forever going around in circles fighting, because the truth be told, and this is also something I regret not having said. You know, the truth be told about our story in this place is that we're not a defeated people, okay? We're not a defeated people. Our greatest victory was the victory of our bodies, the defeat of enslavement. We took our bodies back. We were property here, chattel, and we took our bodies back in the Civil War. That's what we got. Now, people like me are in the classroom because we're working on taking the mind back, right? We're still working on that. It's not done yet, so that's a big struggle. However, our greatest victory is our very bodies. It's our bodies. And we ended the institution of slavery, which for the most part, slavery in America as an institution has existed longer than our freedom in America. You're talking about a 250-plus year institution.
Mm-hmm.
For the history of this country, they had slavery longer than not. And we defeated that institution. Now, certainly, they got, you know, they cut some deals and did this, that, and the other, but we weren't supposed to get our freedom in that war. Okay, that could have went either way, but mm-hmm. we have also decided that we were going to be a part of that and we would take our freedom. That's where the significance of Frederick Douglass comes in at. He's the one who has access to Lincoln and says, you are either a coward or a fool not to let the 500,000 black people, or whatever he might have said, Negro or whatever, but I'm going to say 500,000 African people in this country fight for their freedom. And that's how the Emancipation Proclamation gets issued, and before that, there's the Contraband Act with Robert Small, who sails to the Union side, and then almost half a million people also take their chances and run to Union camps in the South, the very places where they are, and they're neither free or enslaved, and they don't do that with the assistance of the U.S. government at all. So we are the Africans who defeated the institution of enslavement in a place that never wanted to end it. This is the giant, the grand dragon of capitalist nations in the world. We put it into a system where they could capitalize on our labor indefinitely, perpetually. So we got to claim our victory. That being said, sometimes it's good to take your victory and keep it moving, right? Okay, because you are now free. You have the thing you came for, which was your body. You can leave. You'll be okay, because this was hell anyway. So
let me take a couple of these, Richard. Let me take and then you come back. Let me take a couple of these. They've been hanging for a while. Let's go to 267. 267.
Yes, Brother Elliot.
Yes, sir.
Brother Richard.
Yes, yes.
Okay, Dr. Wright, I like what you're saying, and I hear that you were,
a Tuskegee undergraduate graduate, and I am a Lincoln University graduate. And
okay,
one thing, well, I'm going to tell you, sister, I like what you said, because people don't know that Lincoln University was started by two Iberians, mm-hmm. the Amos brothers,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I had once read that in the history of Lincoln that they denied the entrance to matriculation of George Washington Carver. And I said to myself, how could you deny a man like that? But he winds up in Booker T's camp. And anything I can get on Booker T. Washington, I will treasure and read, because a lot of things I didn't know, but I did find out later on the stuff that he did in Africa, that he did in Togo. He had his mechanics to go in Togo, Africa, to learn and to teach them about how to grow cotton and use a mechanism of what he did in the South. He also co-authored a book with Du Bois called The Negro in the South. And if you read that book, you'll see a different position on Du Bois. He's mm-hmm. younger than, and you'll see mm-hmm. the mind of Booker T. Washington. And mm-hmm. of course, Marcus Garvey will only want to see Booker T. Washington mm-hmm. and his vision. So when I hear you say what you say, people look at Booker T. Washington as a seller. The man was born a slave. Who went to Hampton University. And you know, if you ever read how he started the Tuskegee Institute, mm-hmm. how, you know, most of those universities basically started in churches. How they made the bricks, how they did the desks. I mean, it's a phenomenal history that when you hear people talk about Harvard, Yale, and all the rest of those white universities, those PWIs, and investments that they have in slavery, look at that man that came from slavery and look what he did. See the difference.
Right.
I love your talk. I'm going to get your book.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, brother.
Indeed.
Let's go to 602. 602.
Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, and good evening, Dr. Wright.
Oh, wow. Good
evening. Brother Marcus calling from Memphis. You know, Dr. Wright, you gave me some information today that I wasn't aware of. And it's, when I read that book, Up From Slavery, by Booker T. Washington, I don't know anybody could call that man a sellout, because he picked himself up with his, as I said, with his bootstraps, when he didn't have no bootstraps. So,
right.
You know, it's amazing. Now,
right.
Two things I want to address. In reference to the African-American and their contribution to Africa, we don't want to see a repeat of what happened in Liberia, because
right. Absolutely.
We definitely don't want that. And we see a movement now of many of our people are returning to the continent. So I agree with you. We have to intermarry with our people. We also got to do joint ventures with our
mm-hmm.
people. You know, so we all come up, because we don't want to go there and create a money class over
mm-hmm.
our people. That will
mm-hmm.
cause problems. But we
right.
also have to remember that on the continent, our people have issues too.
That's
because
right.
Because they have issues of tribalism. You know, I read
right.
that book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, with
right.
Walter Rodney, and how they play one tribe against the other tribe. You know, we see
absolutely.
Some things that similar to that going on now in Nigeria, stirring
right.
up in Nigeria, where, you know. So we
right.
have to be very, very careful. I think that the African-American experience, their experience in America
mm-hmm.
from
mm-hmm.
the treatment of the European created a more racially conscious mindset about our blackness here in this part of the world as black people, because
right.
the white man, so he consistently kept his foot on the necks of black people here in America, and that developed a different psychology for the black people here that can be of benefit to the continent, because
we will go with the mentality, look, we are one. We are one people. It's a race first mentality. And that mentality will bind us, because although we are one on the continent, you know, a lot of our people don't see themselves as one, you know. They don't see race. A lot of our people on the continent can't see race, although we are there together, you see, because they have a different, developed with a different psychology, because some didn't really have the European directly on top of their head. They had the flunky on top of their head. So he was behind the scene committing the act. He's behind the scene pulling the lever, and the flunky is putting on what he want to put down. So that creates a different psychology with the African and the continent. Then you have the European. He come in with aid, giving the African rice and this. So when you come and talk against the European, they look at you kind of side-eyed. Say, what the hell are you talking about? You know? So it's so much confusion that we have to sift through. But we're going to sift through it, because that's the type of people we are. We survived it, as you said. Their intent wasn't for us to survive. But we are here. We're talking right now on the phone. So we survived, you know. And I appreciate this forum this evening. Thank you so much, Doctor. Thank you, Richard and Elliot. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your contribution.
Mm-hmm. All right, man.
Richard, you were, because I wanted to get a couple of, they had been waiting. I want to, go ahead. You had been mentioned, you had, we're going to mention.
No, something. Well, I don't know if I should bring it up, because, Dr. Wright, you once again, as the, roundtable discussion and what Brother Omowale did with the Un-American Dilemma and what you mentioned about our, bodies, having control of our bodies. I've been enunciating that we haven't, though I understand historically what has happened, you know, liberating ourselves out of doing what they call their civil war, how we liberated ourselves. I got that. But I'm just, you know, the control, and maybe because I think, you know, I believe that without your mind, you don't have control over your body. And we're so wedded to this capitalist order, or to these people. And that's, I guess, what Elliot had brought up, one side of the sword as far as, you know, the whole thing. And the other side being the scholar that felt that he didn't want to lose his job by being able to, you know, kind of challenge the work that was done on Booker T. Washington. And what the discussion in the conference was around also about this buffer class that is keeping us not, if I don't want to use the word oppressed, but it seems to keep us in a position where we're not developing, continues to develop fully to our capacity, as you enunciated. So I'm kind of tugging with myself. If we're not doing that, aren't our bodies still wedded or captured in this here system, especially the system of capitalism? And I don't know if that's a question more than just trying to project, you know, the help you're giving by enunciating what you did, but just the concern I'm having within myself about how free are we here?
I hear exactly what you're speaking to, and I don't disagree. It's just that it's in layers, meaning that you didn't have to check with anyone today to be on this call, to be on this show, right?
Right.
But our larger, yes, our struggle post-liberating our bodies is our struggle over our minds. Mm-hmm. And this is why ideological development and political education are important, okay? Because, if you capture the mind, so you control the body, but physically, in a very hard, concrete way, physically, we got our bodies out of the deal. Okay, my life is nothing like the life of my ancestors. I can literally wake up and decide what I do with my day. And now I could, the system is set up that if I just make certain choices, I will suffer, right? So there's impetus for me to choose the things that are more beneficial to the establishment, right? However, they also have it set up that if I decide to do nothing, that also benefits the establishment. So mm-hmm. I get how on many levels we are still exploited, and I think we acknowledge that. However, if you read, you know, narratives like Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, my life is not like hers, okay? And she was seen as more privileged than the field slave person who was in the slaves, right? She's living in the house, but she's dealing with being enslaved and being enslaved by a sexual predator because she's a woman who can be raped, not to say that they didn't rape men, because they did. They did that too. However, we understand what the outcome can be when you rape women. She's living with a sexual predator. I will never forget when I use this book in historical or literary courses, there's one line that I always highlight, which is that she says in regard to her day-to-day life that there was nowhere, not even her own mother's grave, that she could go to where his shadow did not fall on her. She wished she had the life of the African who was enslaved in the field. My life is not that. At all. It's not that, okay? The constant, I know the terror of being an African and a woman in this society, and it's very dangerous for me. The more mature I get, the more I understand how dangerous it is to me. But can you imagine being in a time where no one has a reason to preserve your life at all? That's not what we're living with. We're not living that life, okay? We're just not. You know, I'm well insulated, and on top of that, if I so decide to protect my life on my own, I can do that. You know, so we really do have to. And who do we have to thank for that? Our own ancestors, and nobody else to thank for that. That's what my ancestors gave me, right? Even before it became popular for people to take a knee or this and that and the other, I always, as a historian, always, because I live in, you know, the past, right? I constantly recall the past as a profession, as my occupation. However, I always, it's always clear, like, we have no one here to thank but ourselves, our own ancestors. And that being said, that's part of the reason why I said, you know, we've got to move forward. Right? Because we are our best thing. And then also forward, meaning into the world, go back out into the world. Don't be scared to go back out into the world. We are African, and that means human. And this world actually belongs to us. Hopefully you choose Africa and build Africa, but we're free to go anywhere we want to. We don't have to stay here in this abusive relationship, you know, and we don't have to be, and we can use this place as an extraction site. Sure. Take money out of here. Have your business here. Have your property here. Create, get revenue from here and put it where you want to put it in the world, right? Because other people do it all the time.
Yeah.
Okay? So.
And I appreciate you. I appreciate that. You know, and I hope that not just helped me, but help others of us who are wrestling with, you know, just that freedom or more intrinsically that fear. Right. I mean, because it's really the fear of wanting to liberate ourselves or to continue the process of liberation is what's holding us back.
Right. And also, too, the idea, this is a daunting thing to give the next generation. You have to stay here. You have to stay here fighting this death lock of a struggle that there seems to be no resolution to, because the very people who are responsible for state-sanctioned murders on the street are the same people you will have to stop that. You know, I was listening to a report, an interview from the jurist in the Breonna Taylor case, and it's ridiculous because the same AG that, you know, botched the case to the grand jury is the same one who will have to make a decision to appoint a special a special attorney to try the case all over again, you know, or a special district attorney, right? A special prosecutor, so to speak. That's the actual terminology, special prosecutor. So that same individual, and he totally botched it, but this is the thing. Where do you see what you're out, you know, of a situation like that where it's obvious that this is, like, horrific, right? Obvious, you know. This is, we can do better than this. America's all we have to offer the next generation. We don't have much to offer because we cannot protect our lives right now. Okay, 150 plus years into our physical liberation. Okay, and that's the reality. I mean, and we're not really. We haven't been willing. We haven't produced the people who are willing. Right now, maybe we have some of the people living who are willing to do some of the things that make the cost of taking our lives too great to do it. But that hasn't happened in that way, right? So they've yet to be born or they've yet to come to maturity, right? Those people who will put an end to that. Now, since we're not, we've got to be real with ourselves. Since we're not those people right this minute, we've got to come up with some other solutions. I don't have to kill anybody to go back to Africa. You know what I'm saying? I don't have to hurt anybody to, and trust me, they make it hard for you to, you know, go back to the continent, whatever. But then there's other things that are... once you get into the groove, you can't imagine not having an international context. And I think that we've got to do that. We've got to step back out in the world. And for those who stay, there's no problem with staying. The terms of our presence here and the fight will be continuous is that we cannot allow our life to be taken with no recourse. But that's going to rage, that battle, for a long time until we produce those people who understand the people we're dealing with, right? We're dealing with a very violent society. There's nothing here that we haven't done. We're living in the backlash of the progress we made the first 50 years out of enslavement. They promised we'll never have that kind of progress ever again. This is why all of our progressive Black industrial communities have been destroyed, and they haven't been destroyed in any sophisticated way. They were destroyed with unbridled violence. And that's it. I mean, when the guy next to you is violent enough to burn your house down because it's bigger than his, or he doesn't like it, you know, he feels like it's a challenge to him, and the establishment doesn't have any recourse for that, then what are you supposed to do? So, you know, I do feel like we've got to just open the door again, step back out into the world, and not engage in this propaganda that says that we shouldn't, that we need to work this out here. We don't have to work this out here. We have to protect our lives because, like Malcolm said, don't give my life away. My life is the best thing I have, right? So we're not going to say that you can take our lives, but we are still at ground zero. We've been fighting that battle since we've gotten here, came here, right? We're still fighting that. And we're still, you know, Breonna Taylor case, what did they say? They said an injury report was filed as a result of them raiding her house. And they said injuries to the victim, none. Although she had been shot 5 times, which caused her death. Injuries to the victim, none. If that's not eye-opening enough, I don't know what is. Even if we want to give a different case, Eric Garner, right? We saw him be murdered in broad daylight with an illegal chokehold. The coroner was brave enough on that little wicked island called Staten Island in New York to say homicide, right? After the autopsy, as a result of the autopsy, homicide, which means another person killed this person. And that individual, Patton Tellino, or whatever his name is, the officer who did this, who murdered Eric Garner, did not go to jail. 5 years later, he lost his job. But that case went straight to the federal level. At the time, you had Barack Obama in office, mm-hmm. and you had a Black male attorney general, Eric Holder.
And after that, you will have Loretta Lynch. That case never was looked at on the federal level. They left it on the desk for the Trump administration, which to me is I mean, you couldn't get a bigger open slap in the face than that. Okay?
I think I just read an article the other day that the Tamir Rice case on a federal level has just disappeared.
Right. So this idea that having black faces in high places, that it does stuff for us, it doesn't do anything. It's a neo-colonial kind of characteristic to that for us here. Right? Just a black face. As I tell plenty of people, black presence doesn't mean black progress. Okay? We need to qualify everything here. And so it doesn't mean progress. But, like, you know, what should be the price for an Eric Garner's life or Breonna Taylor's life? We keep getting, in the legal terms, conclusively, a decision that says our lives are not worth recourse, which means one significant thing constitutionally. This Constitution does not apply to your life. Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Well, you can't have the other little stuff or the trinkets, liberty and pursuit of happiness, without life. So the very Constitution in this place should protect your life. We are still struggling around that. And that's the basis upon which I challenge many people who said how American they are. Okay, great. You must be talking about citizenship. And if that is the case, as a citizen, can you invoke the Constitution to protect your life? You cannot. We have too many instances where that, all of the instances usually say you cannot. So that being the point, now what is your next game plan? And this is not the center of the world. This is not, we're living in a very important time. We're seeing really probably the dismantling of this place in a way that we probably could never imagine. Look at what's going on right now, right? We're all locked in our houses still and maybe more locked in going into the winter. We could never foresee this, never could imagine this. However, the impossible is possible. And the reality is that in our lifetime, we will see probably a significant change in how the United States as a constant nation expresses itself. We may see a dismantling of the actual franchise on a large scale. So we should be prepared. This is not the center of the world. Part of America's greatest propaganda tool has been us, because we have transformed this society to make it look like a place other people should come. But we know that we have been the bodies, the human fuel, and the impetus for a superficial transformation of this society. And so with that, we should also understand that there's more, and we are, it's us, right? It's us. We're our best thing, and we should be fearless in engaging the world. My position, we got to look at it.
Dr. Wright, let me, in some of the time that we have left, I want to infuse a couple of these questions that was asked on day two roundtable. Because, you know, just like Malcolm said over 50 years ago, we're in a explosive political year, I'll put it that way. And a lot of our people is have this political conversation to the point where they almost did something similar to what Maxine Waters said about that she'll never forgive black supporters right. of the Republican Party or whatever. So here's a question, because now I'll read the question, but I'm going to preface it, and then I'm going to let you kind of throw some things in on it. The question that was asked on the second day roundtable, it says, can a black united front between nationalists and integrationists be sustained in the current political environment? Now, let me put this on top of the question and get you to expound on it. These conversations, or this environment, so to speak, take the European out of the picture for right now. Just push him to the side. This integrationist nationalist mentality has been present among our people for at least 150 years Richard talks about some of the Negro conventions of the past, and some of these same conversations was coming up between our people. Now, it wasn't integration at that time because that wasn't even on the table. It was more of an assimilationist as opposed to a nationalist. These conversations has always been had. Would you agree, Richard?
Yeah, that's the way I'm seeing it.
Now, if you look now, these conversations are not being had among our people. And I think there's a lot of reasons in why, and Europeans are at the top of some of the reasons, because they've gotten wise to some of the things where they can use against our people and attack our people. But if the conversations was had during our people 100 years ago, these same conversations, why can't we come up with constructive ways now? Because it's obvious to me that a lot of our people don't necessarily see us as Pan-Africans or even leaving this country. Some of our people want to stay here. Their life is here. But if that's the case, we can't find constructive ways to work with one another, especially if we have the love of our people in the forefront. Maybe I'm framing the question wrong, but help me with that, what I'm trying to say, Dr. Wright.
I think what you're asking is how do people who long-term see themselves still part of the American structure, at least in a constituted way, how can we still engage with people who may see expatriation as viable and who may see connecting with the continent or even other places, but primarily with the continent as an option for maybe even their descendants or for them economically, right? Because
yes.
That's the other part of it too, meaning that we can have a presence, but we also can turn our attention in terms of economic growth and development towards the continent as opposed to into America, right? Constantly reinvesting in America in ways that we don't necessarily have to. Well, I think that, listen, in the book, to go back to my book, there is a conversation there in chapter 4 about the chapter called Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and Africa and his African nationalist affiliates. And in that chapter, there's a couple of different scenarios, but what's also addressed in there is Washington's direct correspondence with African nationalists who are from the continent, came to America, encountered him in some way, either in person or writing, and then went back home to Africa. But I'm saying all of that to say that one of the key issues that is addressed is this whole back to Africa conversation. And Washington post Tuskegee does not pretend that he's going to go to Africa. Okay. He's wedded to Tuskegee. This is his baby. Okay. He is tied to it. And so I'm sure he probably saw it early in life. He knew he would live and die there. However, he is very explicit, and I use his exact words from his personal paper. So it's documented there. Right from the Booker T. Washington papers, he says that he had to consider, because of his serious respect, his level for respect for Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, he had to look at the context of Africa. He had to explore how viable Africa was for the, he says, Negro in America. Okay? And it wasn't in opposition to Henry McNeil Turner. He's saying my respect for him as somebody who I know, but also as someone who is a proponent of the Back to Africa movement. So there is a portion in that chapter where Washington on the Back to Africa movement is addressed. And he has great deal of respect for him, but also, too, what he concludes is that he educates himself even more about Africa and notices that Europeans are all over carving up the continent, and in the places where they have not stated claim, they are trying to say that these territories are in their sphere of influence. And so he deems it as not viable at the time. Now, take into account, that's before African liberation. And yes, we have neocolonialism, but that's, you know, that's shortly after the turn of the century, 20 years, you know, not even 30 years after the conference, the Berlin Conference, right? And the carving up of Africa, and World War I would be on the horizon during this period when this dialogue is going on. However, I don't think we can have a dialectical relationship with Africans here in the United States, and those of us who could see repatriating and at least having our energies directed towards and based in Africa. And why is that okay? That's fine, because that is really part of what Garvey is talking about. Africa is our base. And yes, we should build Africa up as our base, and it will support. Listen, our liberation here in America is not going to impact all Africans around the world. But the liberation, part of what got us out here to begin with was the disruption in Africa. We can be real about that.
Yes.
Okay? On many levels, okay? There's levels and layers to the disruption in Africa. Our internal conflicts being exploited. And also then, of course, the introduction of the European and the gun, right, in order to raid and force us out of the continent. So all of those things. And then the vulnerability of the continent post our being sold into slavery, which decimates the population and allows them to be vulnerable for colonization. So the reality is that having a strong base in a unified Africa, and it doesn't have to be United States of Africa, it just needs to be a unified Africa, an Africa that's unified to the benefit of African people, will give us a base to deal with what we're going through out here, a support. And we should look at it that way. We have never been in a vacuum, even in the context of enslavement. We've always had these dialectical relationships going on between, and I think that's something I try to exhibit and give evidence to in that book, and particularly in chapter 4, because you have Henry Sylvester Williams, who's from Trinidad, going to London, speaking to Africans all over from the continent, from the United States, from various places all over the world. Now, if we were doing that then, I mean, you have Duzay mm-hmm. Muhammad Ali, born in Egypt, residing in Nigeria, promoting and distributing both his newspaper, the African Times and Orient Review, along with the Negro World, right? One diasporic African, another a continental African. And those individuals, Duzay, Muhammad Ali, and Garvey, would end up in conversations with Booker T. Washington. And so we have these dialectical relationships going on consistently where we can feed off of each other, support each other. I can't wait to the day where I'm outside of the United States and supporting people who are still here fighting this struggle. Because to me, you could only be fighting for one thing here. You're not going to stage the fight over the franchise. We know how that went already. We know that there are people who succeeded from the United States and call themselves taking a territory. The United States didn't care about those people. They cared about the territory, right? And we saw what that produced. Now, that's the situation we took our freedom in, but that is called the Civil War and one of the U.S. bloodiest history, you know, wars in its history, right? So this, we're not going to get a little piece. They're not going to give us a little state. You hear the word give, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not happening. So the reality is that, you know, the obvious fight is that we need to be able to protect our lives wherever we are in this world and be free of negation on every level. So, yes, there are relationships and dialogue that we can have. I don't think there should be diametrically opposed to each other. People who are, you know, have views and are supporting expatriation versus those who are still here in the United States. I don't feel like we should be opposed. We should be in support of each other, really, largely, you know, and I think that dialogue should happen. You know, a lot of times the reason why people say they don't support it is because they don't see themselves leaving. Okay, you don't see yourself leaving, but what do you want for generations to come?
Exactly.
Do you want us to not go out in the world because we're fearful? And the truth be told, you go to Africa, you get a real pleasant surprise in terms of the reception.
And as you said, you know, the economic, you know, in that framework of that, it doesn't have to be diametrically opposed.
No.
In the framework of the economic relationship, because as we can see now, and as you mentioned about passing on to the generations, as I see, those who want to stay, that don't mean that they can't have trade with Africa, which would benefit the Black community
a whole
lot more than what they're benefiting now by having, mm-hmm. you know, trade relationships, industrial development, which, you know, your book shows, even with Booker T being modeled, being used in South Africa and in other places, Togo and whatever, being exemplified. These are the way that it can, and being able to, if you want to stay and utilize this policy approach, get the American nation state off the neck of Africa. You know, that can be where, you know, that mutual relationship can occur and be beneficial to both sides.
Absolutely.
You know, in that sense, I'm just feeding off the, you know, the question.
That's precisely. I'm sorry.
No, okay.
That's precisely what Booker T. Washington did, right? That's precisely what he did. Someone who did not characteristically or was not nationally known for promoting social and political rights uses the Black vote as a wager in the Liberian crisis. He tells Theodore Roosevelt, who one can speculate maybe they were friends or maybe they had just a advisor-advisee relationship, but whatever their relationship is, Washington is bold enough to say to him, well, listen, in regard to Liberia, remember, whatever you do or fail to do, and I direct quote it from the letter to Roosevelt from Washington, but whatever you do or fail to do with regard to Liberia, the almost 4 million Negroes in this country will remember it at election time.
Mm.
Now, listen, I'm just, you know, I have to give it up to Washington sometimes because we're not doing that now. We're not doing that. The way, I don't care what that guy looked like in the public realm. I mean, he was unparalleled on a personal level, okay? The way he's talking to these white men and telling them what they are going to do for his people. Amazing, you know? And I said in another interview, I said he was ruthless. And yes, like, come on, we promote or support all kinds of things in this society, but rarely do we have someone who is ruthless for us. Do you get what I'm saying? Ruthless for us.
Right.
Washington wore the mask, sure. He's saying all kinds of things in the public realm to get them off his tail, but his personal papers are very revealing. I don't know. Now, that is something I have to go back and research. I don't understand all the terms at which his papers become public. However, there's about 1,000 boxes of his personal papers that are unpublished, so I'm sure there's even more. But what he is saying in those 15 volumes privately, we are not doing those things now. And he, if he robbed, stole, killed to get what he got, he always came home to us. Mm. Now, our very cause is to elevate and benefit our individual selves. And we want people to think that that means progress for us collectively. It doesn't. You just are well owned by whoever is paying you or paying for you.
Would you say well owned?
Yes, well owned. Most of our people, listen, the reason why this work by Washington wasn't done is because certainly most of our scholars and intellectuals are well owned.
Yes.
Well owned, for sure. And I receive great criticism, even though not direct, because I think you probably could tell that I wouldn't care. But surely I received criticism for releasing. The book was slated for an academic press. I took the book back and went independent with the publication because of the fact that I was not going to allow it to, well, one,
why talk to the same people who are responsible for this debacle with Washington? Manny Marable had the opportunity to tell, to assign meaning to what Washington was up to. No, he decided that it didn't mean anything. Lewis Harlan certainly was invested in maligning Washington. He even talks about that. He's so arrogant. Okay? So the same people that I know tons of scholars, they would never touch this. Because why? For them, they don't know what the benefits. For me, at a certain point, I wrote this book 3 times. In the final writing of the book, I said, I have to just, I was skirting around the Pan-Africanist title, even though all the evidence, brings you to that conclusion, right? Particularly the 2 concrete cases. But it is something that no one has said before. A few people have written things, right, said little statements, okay, but they have not said it in any major way. And then I just said, well, I have to write it without any level of fear. So there's, that piece, right? And then I wrote it the final time, and it was a breeze to write. I took it out of academic language because I had to think, who's my audience? I'm not talking to academicians who, botched this situation altogether and didn't have the courage over the last 100 years to write anything different. I'm writing to our people. This needs to be common knowledge amongst our people. And so then there's all kinds of little business decisions you make too in terms of how to release the work and how you're going to whatever. And I was still on WBAI at the time and just in the right spaces to have a good marketing plan for the book to get out there in a mass way. But the point is that no, yes, our scholars are very often owned. Okay, and are not doing impactful research, and that is obviously to the benefit of our people, and that is obviously going to raise some consciousness and right some wrongs in the historical sense. Yes, all of that, and so, but we've got to push through that. Right? We've got to be, you can't take, for me personally, you can't take something from me that I don't have. So I was totally okay. I was totally at peace with writing the book because it's the truth. And so for me, that was what it was, truth. So I didn't feel any way about it, right? But we have to have more people who are fearless in doing that work and are not so invested in these white institutions and establishment to the point where we can't do the real work, right, for ourselves. So that's what I'm saying about Washington. He did all kinds of things in the public realm to secure what he needed to secure for us. He was not a self-serving individual. What he had at Tuskegee is all he had. And there's a blurry line in terms of his personal wealth and the wealth of the institution, because everything he had, he contributed to the institution. So there's a lot to be said for that. That was when we were a people still. You get what I'm saying? And oh, not definitely. Simply individuals.
Dr. Wright, tell our listening audience how they can, I know it's been out for a little while, but tell them how they can still get the book.
Sure. You can still get the book. The URL is long, but it's Booker T. Washington and Africa.com, and you can still get the book there. It was on Amazon for probably the first year or so, but Amazon is very greedy and it just made the book very expensive and unaffordable, and just kind of that was not my plan. So for the book to be not to be affordable, right? Because this history belongs to us. This is our story, right? And this is, some people think I'm writing about Washington. He is the subject, but the story is really about us. This is about our servant and how well he served us. Okay. And that's really how well he served us, right? We are at the center of it as an African people, and not just served us domestically, but attempted to serve us internationally on the continent and beyond. And so that's really, because listen, if there had been condemnation to give, I would have leveled it with no hesitation. And we've got to bring it back to
it being about African people. So Booker T. Washington in Africa.com, all one continuous phrase with no abbreviation. So Booker T. Washington in Africa.com. And you actually learn a lot. Some people say, oh, we got 2 minutes information on the site. You got to leave some for people to get the book. But listen, it's there for people to, you know, you get a lot of information on the site and you can get the book as well.
I really appreciate it. Once I heard you on the BB to me, I asked Brother Kojo, well, how can I get the book? I think that was like a 3 month back and forth between us. And,
it's still up there.
And he was able to, us to for where I can be able to get it. So,
yeah. And eventually we're going to have an electronic copy, you know, for people. Mm-hmm.
And I'll make sure when I put this, this program up for podcast that I can, and I'll include the links. I'll embed the links. So,
okay.
So when the people
listen
to the podcast, they can also go to
the links. Appreciate it.
I want to thank you for being with us this evening and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Have a good evening.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Take care, Doctor.
Richard, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll wind it down. I want to make that announcement for next week and Professor Al Roon, but we'll do that after the break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. ibbtoomy.com, ibbtoomy.tv, ibbtoomytv.com, ibbtoomy.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. ibbtoomy.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. ibbtoomy.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Commit to You Black family, to join your interconnected Commit to You Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. ibbtoomy.com, ibbtoomy.tv, ibbtoomytv.com, ibbtoomy.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
Thank you.
know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. See, brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda. Thank you.
We have a message to the black man, because the black man today is a man who has been made now almost into a laughing stock. Nobody takes the black man serious. We're just used to be somebody's tool. We are the sportsmen, we're the singers and the dancers, and we're also labeled as the pimps and the criminals and the drug dealers and the killers and the vagabonds of society. We're the bogeymen of British society and other Western systems. And we want to dispel that lie and destroy those myths and put the black man back on the map where we belong. Who is the black man? The black man is the original man. If it wasn't for the black man, no other men could be on this planet. We are the fathers of humanity. We gave birth to all of you.
We are the watchmen on the wall. You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchmen for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is the people vote, but they don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend?
You can't do nothing for me. See, that's what we got to be careful of. We got to be careful of who we bow down to. You see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us. Yeah.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I want to thank Dr. Tyrene Wright for being with us this evening. The book, Booker T. Washington and Africa, The Making of a Pan-Africanist, the links will be available. You can Google it and see the links if you choose to, or you can wait till we put the program up for podcast, because I'll contain the links on the podcast page, and you can just forward it, go forward and link it up through that. Richard,
yes, sir.
Good conversation. A lot of things I didn't know.
Inspiring and necessary.
Yeah, and it's a lot of things I didn't know about Booker T. Washington that was eye-opening this evening. It's really interesting when you can get your hands on some of the papers, whether it's Du Bois, whether it's Booker T. On the papers that a lot of these men wrote, that these universities, you know, the Europeans have done the same thing with some of our people's cultural largesse that they did with some of our ancestors, not some, with our ancestors' mm-hmm. possessions over there on the continent. Mm-hmm. Snatch these things, take them and put them in their universities and libraries, redact them, or take them apart, and then put it out for public consumption, what they want. The mindset is the same.
And you know, Elliot, the other side of that, too, is that we have to start preparing our young people who will have the interest and the courage, the tenacity, and the skills to go and do that work. You know what I mean? To go and sift that stuff out and be able to utilize it and give the interpretation, as she said, that will help us as a people understand choices that we can make, informed choices. Because, you know, I mean, Elliot, you don't know how much I see right now, and it's right now it's even increasing, of these white young scholars and academics are excavating those works.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the next generation is going to be the same thing. It's going to be a group of white scholars interpreting and reinterpreting how we're supposed to see it, even when it comes to saying we immigrated. That's a context that they're creating out of the academy.
Yeah.
We immigrated here. And then you get a Supreme Court justice and an entertainer making the same kind of statement. We immigrated.
Yeah, well, we got some work to do, that's all. And a lot of these people have been doing the work. We're going to keep showcasing what our folks are doing. Before I make this announcement, let me take this call. It's been hanging here. Let's take this. 215-215.
Hey, Brother Elliot.
How are you,
Brother Richard? How y'all brothers doing?
Good.
All right.
Praise be. Yeah, enjoyed your conference. And we call with Dr. Wright. Very, very beautiful sister, man. Very informative. Very, very good information. Definitely a warrior sister. You know, I'm not going to hold you and Elliot too long, but I just want to say a couple of things. And you probably said it, because I missed the beginning of the show. If I didn't, you know, and stuff. I want to, of course, give my condolences to the family of Brother Rob, you know, mm-hmm. who made transition the other day. And also to another brother, I want to tell you and Richard when I called last week, his brother, I don't know if you and Richard heard of Brother Earl Harvey. He's a beautiful brother, man. He made transition. Here's a brother that was, when you talk about Black business, he was like a kindred spirit of Dr. Klingman and stuff. I mean, his brother was all about Black businesses, Black people supporting each other economically. And the beautiful thing about him, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, and to the top, and we can listen to it, is Brother Earl, he's the epitome of what a Black man. He cared for his mother. You know, he used to always tell me, say, "Brother, jump ahead and we drive down Atlantic City to check on my elderly mother and stuff." I mean, this brother really cared about his mom and stuff. And now that he's gone, I'm praying that somebody step up in the family or whatever and take care of his elderly mother and stuff. You know, he died of a sudden heart attack unexpectedly the other week and stuff. But he was just a beautiful brother. Like I said, this brother loved about Black economics, Ellen, which I, you know, like I said, I know Brother Klingman would love him, man, because he was all about that, man, supporting Black business. He said he didn't want to hear no excuses about Black people not supporting our business, whether it be banks, restaurants, whatever. I mean, he was about that. That was his whole life was about, man. He's going to be missed. So along with Brother Rob, and stuff. They were, them two brothers will definitely be missed, man. You know, and a couple more things, Ellen, Richard. You know, it's so sad when you got people like the idiot, the ignoramus. What's that fool's name? We all know Kanye West and the dumb stuff he say, but that other idiot, Lil Wayne and stuff, he bragged about his support for Donald Trump. See, these Negroes, man, just never cease to amaze me. They say this stupid stuff, and they swear they saying something slick when they say that. You know what I mean? I'm like saying, you know, I'm not saying Biden and them is no great shakes, but these Negroes love to get up there and brag. And it's the same fool that said a few years ago, Emmett Till, but Emmett Till's beating her. Emmett Till got a beat down. I'm gonna beat my woman like they beat Emmett Till. I mean, that's like you said, Ellie. They say stupid stuff about their own people, and like you said, Ellie, about the other fool. What's his name? Kanye West. You said for all that stuff he said about Harriet Tubman. You ever notice, Ellie? Like you said, he ain't that damn crazy. He never said about them Jews. He never said about Jewish people, Jewish women, Jewish people, but stuff. I mean, that's no accident. These, you know, him, Lil Wayne. They say all that 50 Cent. They saw that racist, stupid stuff against their own people, but they never make the mistake, Ellen Richard, of saying anything about them Jews. I wonder why. I wonder why. Just food for thought. You know what I mean? Never say anything. You know. But, I mean, these niggas, they need to be ostracized from the black community. And another something that Herschel Walker, the former football player, you're talking about a coon. That is a pathetic excuse for a black man. These Negroes, they are pitiful, man. These Negroes are pitiful. They are pitiful, you know?
Yeah, well,
they are absolutely.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Go ahead, Ellie. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead and finish your thought.
I mean, just want to say these Negroes, they pitiful, got no sense of pride. Yeah. I'm gonna throw sports in there, Elliot. But I just happened to be watching Elliot. Your boy Carson Wentz just threw a dumb interception in the end zone. Yeah. What a nice guy!
I
just had the TV on. I just have to look. I wasn't really paying the game no attention. I just looked at it. So what else is new? But anyway, like I said, these guys they have no respect for their people. And like I say, we need to ostracize them Negroes out the black community. Don't support their records. Don't buy their records. Don't support them. So they got that kind of disrespect for their people and their culture. Don't support them, like we said about the Charles Barkley's and the Shaquille. And we've got to make an example of these Negroes, man. We can't no longer let these Negroes have a free ride since they got such disdain for our people. And so then let the white man support you and stuff. You know, don't support them Negroes, man, because they have total disrespect. You know, Harriet Tubman ain't do nothing. All she did was section say. He would never say that. You could never pay Kanye West to say nothing about some Jewish person, Moshe Dayan or go to my ear and say something derogatory about, because that Negro know what he know. Them Jews that had that Negro, he'd be selling records out of his damn car if he able to do that. But they have no problem degrading their own people, you know. But anyway, Elliot, Rich, I ain't going to hold you. I know the hour's last. I want to get that in, Elliot. Put me on mute and I'll just, you know, listen to the rest of the show.
All right.
Oh, one more thing, Elliot, on election this Tuesday. Again, like you always say, Elliot, if this idiot loses on the Republican side, Trump, again, I would behoove black folks, you know, don't be out here among large segments of white people. And even in the black community, Elliot, because, you know, you got these white boys coming to our community to do some of this killing and stuff like that. Because all these killers, not always black people. So it will behoove black folks, even in our neighborhoods, if the election's coming and it proves that he went, stay in your house. If you want to celebrate that other slave master winning, stay in your house and don't be out here, because it's not above these white boys to come into the black community and do all kinds of stuff, man. You know, shooting black people coming in with masks on, and we as black people, we ain't gonna think nothing's different, because we know we got chaos in our community, so we ain't gonna think the difference. So I mean, these are some things that we need to think about, Ellen Richard. Well, again, Ellen, thanks for your time, you and Richard. Now put me on mute, and I'll, you know, listen to the rest of the show.
Thanks for your contribution.
Thanks, Elliot.
Richard, next week, Professor Ezra Alaron will be joining us, and you know he's been here before on several occasions. You still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been here on several occasions before with the three books that he's written on sovereignty.
Right.
And you know he's been doing work with the African Union and black colleges. Let me share with you and the listening audience what's the second annual GCA-APRM Pan-African Development Virtual Conference, honoring the life and work and vision of Martin R. Delaney. The date is November 12th and 13th of this year. And it'll be hosted by, hosted by the African Union, the Center for Global Africa, .com, the Center for Global Africa, and the African Union, and also Delaware State is going to be the host of the virtual conference. Professor Alarone is the founder and director of the Global Center for Global Africa, and the representative for the African Union, Professor Eddie Maloka, I think that's how you pronounce his name. It's a lot of things that's going to be on the table at the conference. And you, Richard, you can see that some of the things have been in motion already. Professor Alarone will talk about this next week when he comes on. But the conference themes and opportunities that's going to be discussed there is Africa's food and seed security, agricultural values and chains, youth media and reimagining Africa, African diaspora trade and development, HBCU innovation hubs on the continent, and COVID-19 health and technology integrations. So we're looking at these themes, Richard, and they're all very important. And especially now with the COVID-19 health and technology integrations, because we can see on the continent that they have several things that they've been using to combat this disease that our people here know nothing about. All we're doing is sitting waiting for Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson, waiting on this man, in other words. But I've just read an article in, I think it was Reuters, that China is already using some type of vaccine that they've created, if I'm not mistaken. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, I think that, but it hasn't went through all the trials or whatever, but they've been using it in their country. So you see that this mindset that these people have developed globally, it's almost like a sickness. It has spread all over the world. Everybody, instead of working together, I think that the guy, I don't know whether he's got black skin. I don't know whether he's Indian. With the World Health Organization, when he made that impassionate plea and was crying, saying this is a global pandemic and we need to work together. I think he made that plea about 3 months ago. But you can see that some of these folks, the only one that stated that they wanted to consciously mentioned to the world that they were willing to work together was Cuba.
Yeah.
All these other nations, and especially this place, they don't want to work with nobody. It's all about Europeans. They coming up with this quote-unquote vaccine and be able to distribute it. I think they said the government has already allocated $350 million towards distribution of a vaccine. So they already counting money before the vaccine is even created. But, you know, but I'm glad that these things are going to be on the table. The conference themes and opportunities. So that's not only in the workings, but it's opportunities going to be there for all of these things that's slated for the conference.
And you see, we just got finished talking about in general and in the past. And this conference is really what's in operation that we can become informed on and participate in.
And involved in. Yeah, exactly. And the Center for Global, I'm trying to read this thing from my phone because he sent the information. The Center for Global Africa and a partnership with the African Union. So we can see that this thing's going on, Richard, that our people need to know about. You're not going to find it out on CNN. Your local black representative is not going to tell you about it for whatever reason. Maybe they get, and who cares about their reasons? We're going to let folks know, and hopefully a lot of people listen in. so they can, if their children are going to school, if they're graduating from school within the next year or two, where they can look for opportunities on the continent, with HBCU hubs opening up on the continent. I think it's a couple of opened up recently. One in Ghana, I think one in Sierra Leone. It's been hubs opening up. We'll get all that information next week when Professor Olerone joins us to kind of preview and give us an overview of the second annual Pan-African Development Virtual Conference. And this one is honoring the work and vision of Dr. Martin R. Delaney. So we're looking forward to his participation next week.
Great.
Before we leave today, I just want to give the lineup on Time for an Awakening Media, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting guests and dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. from 6 to 8. Later Monday evening, Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed from 8 to 9 Monday evenings. Black Therapy Central with the host Dr. Mawia Kamban and Sister Nataki Kamban. Later on, the first and third Monday, but they're on hiatus for the month of November. They'll be starting live programs again in December. It's Conversation Reparations, which is in Cobra's program. On Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, from 7 to 9 p.m., After 7 with host Shani B. On Fridays, Time for an Awakening from 8 to 10. On Saturday, 4 to 6, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And from 7 to 9, The Elders of Sankofa with host Alfonso Watkins. And then Sunday, Time for an Awakening is back from 7 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the thing that they'll soon have to take care of. Children, soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Oh,
children to save the children.